It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to Harry Enten from 538 to get the latest on how Donald Trump's cabinet picks are faring in confirmation hearings and other Washington news.
First, today, President-elect Donald Trump held his first press conference in almost 6 months. The press conference came after CNN and other news outlets reported that briefing materials prepared for Trump included unverified reports that Russia has compromising information about him.
Hours after that report, BuzzFeed published an unverified document they say was the 35-page dossier of memos with information about the alleged facts that Russia is claimed to have on Trump.
These reports got a lot of attention in today's press conference before Trump even took the stage. Spokesperson Sean Spicer addressed the publication of these documents.
For all the talk lately about fake news, this political witch hunt by some in the media is based on some of the most flimsy reporting, and it's frankly shameful and disgraceful.
Mike Wagner joins us to talk about the press conference and the relationship between the press and the president-elect. Mike's an associate professor of journalism and mass communications at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, this press conference kicked off on a raucous note because of the publication of this alleged information.
It really did, and then it kicked off with several attacks on the news media, most notably, of course, coming from President-elect Trump himself, which I think is a signal that we'll get more of the same from him in terms of his treatment of the news media that we saw in the campaign, we're likely to see in the Trump presidency.
There had been a lot of criticism for Hillary Clinton for long gaps between press conferences during the campaign. Now the press has had a drumbeat. When is Donald Trump going to have one after his election? What do you make of the timing?
Well, I think he had held off for about as long as he could have, I think. And so having one now, I think, also detracts attention away from the Tillerson confirmation hearings for his proposed Secretary of State. Those have been rough for his nominee. And so having Trump himself be in a news conference, I think, makes that the headline, makes that the top story. And so I think that's one of the reasons he's choosing to do that now.
Now, before Trump took the stage, Vice President-elect Mike Pence introduced him, and he had something to say about the publication of these documents by BuzzFeed.
You know, I have long been a supporter of a free and independent press, and I always will be. But with freedom comes responsibility. And the irresponsible decision of a few news organizations to run with a false and unsubstantiated report when most news organizations resisted the temptation to propagate this fake news can only be attributed to media bias, an attempt to demean the president-elect and our incoming administration, and the American people are sick and tired of it.
So with press freedom comes responsibility.
Well, I think journalists are bound to behave in an ethical way, and it's their job, I would say, to report the verifiable truth. And a lot of organizations like CNN said, we have this document, there are explosive allegations in it. Since we can't verify it, we're not going to talk about what's in it, but we have it, and we're investigating. And that seems to be a more appropriate way of going about things than BuzzFeed's way, which is to say, here's 35 pages of accusations about Donald Trump. We don't know if they're true or not. And so I can understand Vice President-elect Pence and President-elect Trump blanching at the release of that report the way that BuzzFeed did it. BuzzFeed said that their ethic was, we release it, you read it, you decide for yourself whether you think it's true, but that puts a lot on regular people. How do they vet 35 pages of information in an intelligence report? And so I think journalists are supposed to play a role here to help us understand the verifiable truth.
Talking to Mike Wagner from UW-Madison about Donald Trump's press conference earlier today. Let's get into the relationship between the reporters there and Donald Trump in a heated back and forth kind of between a CNN reporter and Donald Trump, not looking to them for a question. Here's a listen. I guess we don't have that up here. So there was a tough back and forth. CNN, do we have that? Okay, let's give a listen.
Since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance
Let's
to
go.
Ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can
Quiet.
You state, can,
Quiet.
Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically?
She's asking a question. Don't
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be
you're
rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you
no,
give
I'm not
us a question?
Give you a I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody... No, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
So an audience there of some sort, but I'm not going to take your question. You're fake news, CNN.
Yeah, that was pretty striking to have President-elect Trump call CNN a fake news organization. Now, I mean, if you go back and you maybe on YouTube watch some Ronald Reagan and Sam Donaldson back and forth. Sam Donaldson was the ABC White House reporter for a time. There were lots of those kind of shouting back and forth and, you know, reporters yelling questions as Jim Acosta of CNN was in that clip. But Trump has never, and to my knowledge, his staff has not said what they thought was inaccurate about CNN's report.
Right. That's different than what BuzzFeed did.
That's right.
CNN did not post the document.
They did not. And it is not clear what Trump's objection is to CNN's reporting of that, other than to say, by talking about it at all, it's disgraceful in Trump's formulation. But CNN, I think, behaved appropriately in that situation.
Have we seen presidents single out news media, particular organizations, to not very publicly not take questions from before?
We have attacked the press, or political elites have attacked the press since there's been one. And mm-hmm. so you can think back to the Watergate time and Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, regularly attacked the Washington Post, the New York Times, Dan Rather of CBS News. And so it's a tried and true strategy. And President-elect Trump, does it more aggressively and without expressing what he believes the facts are to discredit who he's trying to discredit. And so I think that's much more dangerous than what we've seen in recent years.
To what extent, when it comes to president-press relationships, are we in new territory here versus precedent?
Well, I think what's new is how aggressive and public Trump is about calling reporters out, even at rallies, pointing out there's the reporter's pen, that one in particular is terrible, which he has done to Katie Turr of NBC and Jenna Jacobs of The Washington Post. And he's calling out reporters by name in rallies where people are getting pretty hot and bothered by the claims that Trump makes about the news media. So that, I think, is fairly dangerous. And Trump's kicking the Washington Post out of kind of his press corps during the campaign, threatening today. His press secretary, according to the CNN reporter, told Jim Acosta of CNN, if you speak up again, we're going to throw you out of this press conference. And so that sort of thing is unique and dangerous.
What is a reporter to do in this situation? How can a reporter in this situation best do their job?
Well, I think it's totally appropriate to try to ask questions when someone like the president-elect is making himself available in a press conference, and you know, and trying to get the attention of that person is appropriate. I think that journalists can also work to try to make it so that president-elect and eventually President Trump doesn't just get to set the agenda by tweeting. And instead of just reporting what he tweets or putting his tweets in a headline, journalists exercising some of their own editorial control about what is and isn't newsworthy and what is and isn't verifiable would be things journalists could do to help reassert their role in this adversarial relationship between the news media and politicians.
An interesting phenomenon I'm seeing is real-time transcripting and, as close as possible, real-time fact-checking.
Right.
And then soon after, posting the full transcript with a growing number of highlighted links where you can get more background on the statement.
That is a major development in the news media in this century. And even today on the New York Times website, there was a fairly, as you say, almost live fact check of the claims that Trump was making. Some were on Trump's side when Trump said, "I'm the president. I don't have to abide by these anti-nepotism laws." That's true to the extent we can tell. And Trump saying, "I'm going to repeal and replace Obamacare within an hour." That's very unlikely to happen. And that live fact check from the Times' website pointed out why that would be. And so we're seeing a lot more of that. There's a danger to getting a fact check wrong. The last thing you want to do as a fact checker is get a fact wrong. But it does a great service, I think, to readers and audience members to have that happen.
Let's talk fake news now. Originally, as I understand it, my working definition of fake news is there's someone out there, they post something that looks like news, they made it up, whole cloth.
Right.
Now we're seeing more and more news that's a bit wrong or that is unfavorable to me or that quotes something that's unverifiable. the word fake news has had a mission creep in what it means.
Yes, there's been a significant mission creep, especially from those who want to discredit the news media. And so if there's a story that a politician doesn't like, that politician and his or her supporters will say, oh, well, that's fake news. And then they start even tying it to the organization, as President-elect Trump did today, saying CNN is a fake news organization. CNN is a journalistic organization. They make mistakes. They do lots of things in ways I wouldn't do them, but they're not fake news.
Briefly, as we wrap up, what are you looking for? What are you hoping for when it comes to media access to the new administration?
Well, I hope that reporters think about what media critic Jay Rosen has called an outside-in strategy. Too much journalism is predicated on the notion that having access to those who are in power is the most important thing. But it's also the case that reporting around the edges of power and reporting within various elements of the administration in the various, different offices that run the government and reporting from the outside in can be just as useful as trying to have access to that one person who's at the seat of power. And Trump generates attention by knowing that what reporters want is access to him. That's why he tweets the way he does. That's why he makes himself available in the way he does. And to take that power away from him would make it harder for him to obfuscate, which is one of his major strategies when dealing with the press.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the relationship between President-elect Donald Trump and the news media after Trump's first press conference since he won the presidential election. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Governor Walker announced that he wants the state to ramp up efforts to fight heroin and opioid addiction in Wisconsin. We'll talk to someone working on the front lines of the opioid epidemic.
Right now, it's our weekly check-in on the latest news from Washington. Yesterday marked the first day of Senate confirmation hearings for President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominees.
Secretary of State nominee and former ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson faced questions today, which got heated as Tillerson was asked about climate change and Russia. And lawmakers took the stand today to argue against the confirmation of Senator Jeff Sessions as Attorney General.
Also, the topic of vaccinations could be the subject of partisan politics. Harry Enten joins us now. He's a senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's start with this news that swept social media last night. President-elect Donald Trump gave his first news conference in a while after this BuzzFeed release of a dossier containing unconfirmed information alleging that Russia had incriminating or embarrassing information on the president-elect. Again, unverified information. As a journalist, what did you think of the release of that dossier?
Well, I'm not in the BuzzFeed universe necessarily. I think we should separate out CNN, which reported on it, and then BuzzFeed, which released it. Those are two separate things. My colleagues and I had some differing opinions on that. My belief, generally speaking, is if it's unverified, and we, for instance, know that many news organizations had that dossier for a long while, I would not have released it insofar as there are a lot of salacious things in that, a lot of which BuzzFeed itself said, or at least some of it, which BuzzFeed said itself was not true. I think it's just a very difficult call. I don't call out BuzzFeed for releasing it. If it was up to me, I wouldn't have released it versus the CNN, where they just kind of summarized and reported some of it. That, to me, is a little more acceptable, but clearly Trump, in his press conference today, didn't really differentiate too much between BuzzFeed and CNN. He just said that it was all fake news, and as your previous guest said, CNN is not in the business of fake news. You can agree or disagree with their editorial standpoint for putting this out, but at the end of the day, they're a real news organization, and my fear, of course, is that the media, everything that one side doesn't like, they'll say the media is fake news, and something the other side doesn't like, they'll say it's fake news, and that to me is very dangerous because then we'll be able to not agree on basic facts.
And there was a new poll just released looking at Trump's approval ratings before, obviously, this story we're just talking about, the dossier alleging some information about Donald Trump. But tell us about that new poll and where he stands.
Well, this is the thing that somehow has occurred, which is quite interesting to, I think, a lot of us, as Donald Trump remains, including in this new Quinnipiac poll that was out yesterday, his approval rating and his favorability rating are, 40% or lower, and that is pretty much in the vast majority of polls, and the Quinnipiac poll basically reiterates that. he is going to come into office as the least liked president in recorded history, at least since we've been conducting polls. And there's a real question as to how he'll be able to govern with such a low approval rating. It may be the case that he'll be able to govern just fine because he and the Senate and the House, which are controlled by Republicans, will say, look, I had those low approval ratings during the campaign, so who cares? But it could also be the case that senators and House members on the Republican side of the aisle who disagree with him will use his low popularity and saying, you know what, maybe I want to distance myself from the president.
Let's move on to the transition of the White House. Confirmation hearings kicking off yesterday. Senator Jeff Sessions started off, a nominee for attorney general. Some protests, long day of testimony yesterday. Today, lawmakers were taking the stand to testify against his confirmation. Here's a Democrat, Democratic Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey.
Challenges of race in America cannot be addressed if we refuse to confront them. Persistent biases cannot be defended unless we combat them. The arc of the moral universe does not just naturally curve towards justice. We must bend it. If one is to be attorney general, they must be willing to continue the hallowed tradition in our country of fighting for justice for all, for equal justice, for civil rights. America needs an attorney general who is resolute and determined to bend the arc. Senator Sessions' record does not speak to that desire, intention, or will.
So a sitting senator criticizing in public testimony another sitting senator in his confirmation hearing for attorney general, not something we see every day.
And no, it's not something we see every day, but to be honest with you, I'm not sure what goes on these days is something that we do see every day. Each day in this new politics world that we live in seems to be unusual and strange, and so I think we might as well get used to it. And that it's an interesting thing insofar as that Cory Booker is generally known as, you know, someone who gets along well with his colleagues and someone who, in fact, has, you know, marched with Mr. Sessions, I believe, or soon to be, I guess, if he gets a confirmed Attorney General Sessions, and has, in fact, been friendly with him in the past. So it was kind of an odd thing, and a lot of people, at least in social media and among reporters, were saying this is a move by Senator Booker merely to sort of position himself for 2020 and be a liberal hero. It was an unusual move. It probably won't derail the nomination, but, you know, here we are, partisan politics.
And another part of the confirmation hearings, former ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson began his hearings as Secretary of State, and he'd been seen as a controversial choice. How has that been playing out so far in the Senate?
Well, if the Booker, if the Sessions confirmation hearing was smoke, then the Tillerson confirmation hearings were fire. This is, I think, the best shot, at least of the biggest positions, maybe with the exception of Secretary of the Treasury, of having Trump not get who he wants. Marco Rubio particularly quizzed Tillerson very, very hard today. And to me, this looks like a chance where he may not get confirmed in part because of his ties to Russia, which obviously have been in the news in the past 24 hours when Tillerson was the head of ExxonMobil.
Let's listen to Senator Rubio and Rex Tillerson. Rubio asked him if he would consider Russian President Vladimir Putin a war criminal because of Syria and other issues. Here's part of that exchange.
I understand there is a body of record in the public domain. I'm sure there's a body of record in the classified domain. And I think in order to deal with a serious question like this,
Mr. Tillerson, what's happened in Aleppo is in the public domain. The videos and the pictures are there.
Fully informed before advising the president.
Well, I encourage you. There's so much evidence. There is so much information out there about what's happened in Aleppo. Leaving the Chechen issue aside, what happened there is clearly documented as well. There's so much information out there. It should not be hard to say that Vladimir Putin's military has conducted war crimes in Aleppo because it is never acceptable. You would agree. For a military to specifically target civilians, which is what's happened there through the Russian military. And, I find it discouraging, your inability to cite that, which I think is globally accepted.
And that's a senator from the same party as the nominee here. So that's not something, again, that we see every day.
No, and in fact, we should keep in mind there are 52 Republican senators. You need, 50 plus the one vote from Vice President Pence in order to confirm. So they need to get three no votes on the Republican side if every Democrat also votes no. And with Rubio seeming like he's going to vote no, there are enough Republican senators out there that can sink this nomination without much of a problem. It's not something we see every day, and to me is an indication that the Tillerson nomination, while certainly not dead by any means, is in trouble.
And we're going to move on, Leslie, to talk about vaccines being made especially political now, with Donald Trump looking to appoint Robert F. Kennedy Jr. To an agency that deals with this. What's the latest there, Harry?
Well, there are a few things that I should say about this. Number one, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is a conspiracy theorist and a vaccine truther, despite the fact that we know and the government confirms it's a widely discredited claim that vaccines cause autism. They do not. But Kennedy believes that. And Trump has made any number of statements saying that, we should look into this issue. And they met yesterday. And essentially, Kennedy said that he, or at least he told reporters, that Trump had asked him to chair a commission on vaccines and scientific integrity. Trump's people say that's not exactly the case. But I should point out that most people believe that vaccines do not cause autism, that they are safe. But the real danger here is if someone, a Republican president like Trump, were to take up the issue, there's a real chance that it can become polarized across the political spectrum. And that's obviously not something that's very good.
Right. You see a precedent in Russia where there used to be kind of partisan agreement, both parties pretty similar on attitudes toward Russia. That's changed recently in polling. You fear that we could see a sudden jump, all of a sudden vaccines, Republicans hate them, Democrats like them.
Right. I'm not sure that Republicans necessarily hate them, but it could be the case where even if just it climbs a little bit, it could be dangerous to the public health. And we did see that in Russia, in public opinion towards Russia, whereby going back to the Soviet Union days in the mid-70s, Democrats and Republicans, even if, say, they started liking Russia, they liked Russia at the same pace, or they then disliked Russia at the same pace, versus now when Trump all of a sudden started saying nice things about Russia and Putin, Republicans started liking Russia and Putin more than Democrats did. We saw the same thing with the Electoral College, where usually Republicans were less likely to want to change the system to a popular vote, but it wasn't that big of a difference, versus now after the election, Republicans are far more likely to say, not surprisingly, that they want to stick to the Electoral College. And we see it throughout history as well on scientific issues, global warming, for instance, where Democrats and Republicans have seen polarization, and that's just something we can't afford on vaccines.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. He joined us to talk about the ongoing Senate confirmation hearings and more political news out of Washington.
Coming up after the news, we talk about new efforts from the state to fight the opioid epidemic and why some advocates say they don't go far enough. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk to a guest who says Wisconsin's spring election could move the state further to the right.
First, the number of heroin deaths in Wisconsin rose for the ninth straight year. That's according to a report from the USA Today Network Wisconsin. And last week, Governor Scott Walker called for a special legislative session to tackle the problem of heroin and other opioid addiction. He said the issue was a public health crisis and that he's directing agencies to ramp up the state's response to addiction.
Those efforts include ordering the State Department of Health Services to apply for up to $7.6 million a year in federal funding to fight addiction and asking the State Department of Corrections to treat drug abusers for addiction during their prison sentences and after their release.
Well, there's been a lot of applause for Walker and the state legislature and their efforts to fight these addictions. Others say we still have a long way to go. Jessica Geschke joins us now. She's been working with people living with addiction for 13 years. She's also director of alcohol and other drug abuse services at Affiliated Clinical Services, a private treatment center in West Bend. And she's president of the organization Stop Heroin Now. Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, what's your reaction, first of all, Jesse, to what you're hearing from state lawmakers and now from the governor on this issue of opioid addiction?
Well, I'm actually pleasantly surprised, and I'm excited. I heard the news that came out, by Governor Scott Walker. I was very, very happy with the task force and what took place with Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish and Representative John Nygren. I think that the opiate task force and the three of them, they came up with some exciting things for our state. You know, and the way I view things is any movement towards helping individuals with addiction is good movement. We need help. So I'm really, really thrilled.
I want to get into some practical measures and where you see the real needs here, but I want to start with kind of the culture of the way we think of addiction, especially when it comes to heroin and opioid medications. I know you've said elsewhere that we need to get past the stigma that we apply to people suffering from these addictions. Why is that an important step?
Well, I mean, I come from, I can give you a little bit about my personal
Sure.
story. My brother is an opiate addict, and he is in recovery currently. And so the stigma, I think, that follows every single individual out there, and it doesn't just have to be heroin addiction. It can be anything, even, you know, those who struggle with alcohol addiction. There's just that stigma of, I'm an addict. I'm a person who has this disease. And it's not like the disease of cancer, you know, and you can even ask a mother who's buried their child from this addiction. If you bury your child from the disease of cancer, people will come and they'll surround you and they'll give you hugs and bring you food and dishes and say, oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry. You bury your kid from the disease of addiction and it's a hush hush. Oh, my gosh, your kid must have been such a terrible person kind of thing. And that needs to stop. This is a disease, it's a brain disorder, and it's the same as any other disease that's out there. And I think that stigma of, well, they chose to do it, they put that needle in their arm, they overdosed and died, so it's a good thing and they should just all die. I mean, I've heard statements like that come from so many people's mouths. And I think if you had a brother, a sister, a loved one, a husband, a wife that was addicted, you wouldn't be saying those things. And breaking that stigma down, breaking those barriers for people to understand that this isn't so much a choice when you can't stop.
Now, you work directly, in addition to your personal experience, you work directly with people suffering from addictions. What services do we need for them in this state that we don't have enough of?
I mean, I work in an outpatient facility. We do intensive outpatient treatment there. And I personally feel that we need more inpatient treatment services, and we lack funding for that. We also have insurance barriers for that, which is why I try to bridge that gap with the nonprofit. I think that we have a lot of issues with when it comes to like probation and parole. There's a huge a need for like treatment alternative diversion programming. I mean, there's tons. I mean, really, just want me to list one. There's a lot of different things that we could do, and I think that we're making those strides and steps now, moving in those directions.
Now, this idea of federal funding through the Cures Act that the state is going to be applying for, where would that money go that would make the most difference?
I mean, I think that money is going to go in a bunch of different areas. I mean, I'm not really sure what the plan is. I think that Governor Walker and the task force was allocating some of that money towards, like, school funding for, like, the administration of Narcan. I read something about being able to, you know, help kids, or that, like, so teachers can do Narcan on kids in school. And a lot of backlash came from that. And I heard people saying, well, why would we need Narcan in our high schools? And I can tell you, I've done assessments in my practice on 12-year-olds with track marks. And I know it's easy as an adult to sit back and cast judgment on other adults and suggest that, you know, a heroin addict asked for the disease, and if they're addicted to heroin, they should just stop. But when you look at a 12-year-old kid sitting in my office with track marks, or a 12-year-old who's died in a bathroom of a high school because he didn't have access to Narcan, it's not so easy to judge. And so that would be a great place for that, you know, some of that treatment funding to go to. I'm sure that I can't remember where else there was some more million-dollar, you know, grant money going just for the addiction treatment itself. And as a provider, that helps. I mean, that interests me for that money to go to just daily treatment. People can't get into treatment because they don't have it. They don't have insurance. They can't afford insurance. There's a huge gap there. It's a vicious cycle.
Talking to Jessica Geschke. She is with the group Stop Heroin Now, and she's director of alcohol and other drug abuse services at Affiliated Clinical Services in West Bend. Let's talk a little bit about prevention, Jesse. We've heard this again and again from the Attorney General on this show, Brad Schimmel, from Representative Don Nygren. You mentioned people working in this, that the cheapest and most effective way to deal with this is to try to keep people from getting addicted in the first place. What do we need? What do you see us needing to help with that?
I think prevention measures can come in multiple fashions. I'm a big advocate for schools. We go in and we speak at schools. I speak with an organization called Rise Together in schools. Prevention measures is getting to our youth. Our youth are our future. And we need to get into those school districts. We need to get parents educated as to what to look for in your youth that could be using. We need to start, you know, with our youth, and we need to get them educated not to even start or pick up.
And then with someone who's already addicted, as I understand it, you know, even if they do get access to treatment, even if they have some kind of access to treatment, it doesn't always work the first time, but it might work the second or fifth time. How do we make sure that we keep getting access to treatment, even if the first round isn't a success?
That's the million-dollar question. I think, you know, giving individuals access to treatment, that's one of the hardest things that we have. And that's where we have this vicious cycle, because if people say, let's say they have access to treatment because they have great insurance, by the time they get through that, you know, first round of treatment, they get back to their jobs, they end up relapsing, they lose their job, they lose their insurance. Sometimes they might get a legal ramification, they end up in jail, they lose their insurance. So I don't have the answer for that. I don't know how to continue with people and keeping them sober long enough to get them to be productive, other than just keeping the door open. I mean, that's what we do at our treatment agency. They're always welcome back. I've implemented that with my own home life and with my brother's addiction. You know, he has been addicted to opiates for the last 10 years, and we have been in and out of treatment agencies throughout Wisconsin and beyond. I think, like, that family support, I have never once turned my back on my brother, no matter what he's done to me. There have been times, I will not lie, that I have almost, I've been in very dark places where I've almost lost it myself because I did not know what to do to help him. And I think it's just key for family members to not give up on your loved ones and to make sure that you're always accessing as much treatment as you possibly can, accessing funding, reaching out, calling people, and just not stopping that ball from rolling until you can get someone to listen to you. And that's what I had to continuously do for my brother, and had to make him make those calls and hold him accountable every single day to make sure he was doing what he needed to do to maintain his sobriety.
We're talking to Jessie Geschke. She's director of alcohol and other drug abuse services at Affiliated Clinical Services in West Bend.
You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Is opioid abuse something that has affected you or people you know, someone in your family? What resources do you think your community needs to tackle that issue? And what do you think the state should do to face the opioid epidemic? If you or someone you know has recovered from addiction, what helped you the most? Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Jessie Geschke, Director of Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Services at Affiliated Clinical Services in West Bend, talking about heroin addiction and treatment in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're someone who's been affected by heroin or other opioid addiction, give us a call. Or if you work on the treatment side, we'd love to hear from you. And you can tell us if you're happy with the new efforts that Governor Walker has put forward to fight opioid addiction. Is there something else that you think the legislature should be doing? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Jesse, before we go to our callers, I've been throwing around the word treatment. What does, briefly before we go to the calls, what does treatment look like for someone dealing with opioid addiction?
I think treatment can look like a number of different things. It depends on where they're at and their level of commitment. Our state, in Wisconsin, we offer a variety of different levels of treatment. there's outpatient treatment, there's intensive outpatient treatment, there's residential treatment, inpatient treatment. I mean, we have wonderful treatment agencies on an outpatient level of care, and then also we do have inpatient level of care, like such as the Rogers and the Aurora, the Dewey Centers. NOVA is another great inpatient level of care. We do have a couple of those as well in the state. If you're looking for like more long-term, 90-day, you know, care, we do send people out of state for those. Otherwise, you know, we do have like the Beacon House up in Fond du Lac. I mean, it just depends, I guess, where what people are looking for. But a lot of, and that's where I'm, you know, when I'm speaking about like what we could use here in Wisconsin, most of the people in Wisconsin who have, let's say, have done heroin treatment for heroin addiction over and over and over, and it's just not working, not sticking, they go out of state. They go down to the Arizona, California, or Florida area for 6 months to a year treatment.
Let's go to our callers now. Tim is on the line in Marinette. Tim, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if our legislators and police departments and physicians have ever entertained the idea of just legalizing drugs, period. It's more of a health issue than a legal issue. It seems like these people get hooked on something, and then they get reprimanded for it, and then now they have a record.
Tim, thanks for the call. And Jesse, I don't know if legalization is on the table or a solution, but there have been moves to make it less of a legal liability to report heroin overdoses and things like that.
Yes, and that comes with the HOPE agenda through John Nygren. But legalizing drugs, I mean, I have very strong feelings about that. I think if you look at, we do have legal drugs such as alcohol. You can legally drink alcohol, but does it make it any less of an issue in our state? No. We have people dying from drunk driving and alcohol overdose on a daily basis in the state of Wisconsin. So I don't know that legalizing all drugs across the state of Wisconsin is going to solve the heroin epidemic by any means.
Tim, thanks for the call. Go next to Susan in Eagle River. Susan, hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Susan?
I just wanted to say that I'm an addict. I was an active heroin addict for over 40 years. I grew up in Fort Lauderdale where drugs were everywhere, and I thought I was cool and all that nonsense. But as what Jesse was saying, I believe exactly what she said. Education is paramount. These kids have no idea of the life that they're throwing away when they pick up. I know I didn't know.
Susan, and thanks. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to say it's paramount to it's a life and death matter. So it needs to be addressed.
Susan, thank you so much for sharing your experience, and good luck continuing to stay clean. What do you think of Susan's story, Jesse?
I think that's amazing, and congratulations, Susan, on your recovery and your sobriety. That's fantastic. I love hearing about people in recovery. It just brightens my day.
Susan, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Irene in Madison. Irene, hi.
Hi. I would like to differentiate here between responsible use of opioids. There are many people with chronic pain issues who are really getting the pinch and a bad reputation for using fentanyl patches and things like that. And there's a differentiation here between people who are predisposed for addiction and those who responsibly use the medications.
Irene, thanks a lot for the call. And there are legitimate uses for these medications, though, as I understand it, Jesse, the medical profession is moving away from opioids, saying they actually don't necessarily relieve chronic pain. For some people, actually make it worse. Do we need to review how we prescribe to make sure that legitimate uses are still out there, but not prescribe it to people and make them more likely to get addicted?
That is exactly right. There is legitimate uses for pain medications. I don't deny that one bit. But it is true, people with long-term pain who use medications long-term can actually create false pain in your body. I know that John Nygren, and I've had this conversation with him prior, he's taken a lot of slack for that. Lots of people have come and said, John, I don't understand. Like, you're taking away our right to have pain medications. We are not addicts. We do not have problems. I know that they are working on that as far as at the state level, trying to differentiate between people who abuse the medication and people who are being prescribed the medication from physicians. So that is something that we are working on, or he is working on, his task force is working on. And so, you know, just please be patient. And John, I'm sure, can answer any of those questions, too, that people would have, or, you know, his team. And I don't have the answers to that at this point.
And Jesse, briefly in our last minutes, for someone listening who's addicted themselves, who have a friend or family member, briefly some suggestions for them.
I guess just continuing to, you know, keep the open lines of communication. I know, you know, personally, it's super hard to work and be around and support somebody who is struggling. I've been there, and I understand that it's physically and emotionally and mentally exhausting. But in the state of Wisconsin and nationally, like, we are burying four people every minute from an opiate overdose. And so I'm not okay with that, and something has to change. And so we are making those movements and those strides. We are trying to do things here in Wisconsin. And so I guess for me, I just want people to be supportive of our lawmakers, supportive of those individuals, like especially our task force here in Wisconsin, just be supportive of what we are trying to do. And love your loved one, love them unconditionally, try to help them. And if you need support yourself, reach out. That's the best support you can give someone else, is to make sure that you're healthy yourself. And, you know, we're here, Stop Heroin Now. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on the web. We're here to help. That's what we do. That's where our passion lies.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Jesse Geschke with Affiliated Clinical Services in West Bend. Good luck to her and her brother. We've been talking about efforts to treat heroin addiction here in Wisconsin. Find more information with Stop Heroin Now.
The relationship between law enforcement and undocumented immigrants around the country is a controversial issue and was featured prominently in the recent election.
In an ongoing series, WPR News is following a group of Madison police recruits as they go through the training academy.
As Bridget Bowden reports, Madison's officers in training learned about what issues immigrants face from members of the Latino community.
Madison police recruit Gracia Rodriguez came to the United States illegally when she was just 6 years old.
I was one of those that came here with a visa and stayed. My family didn't want to go back due to the Mexico being, we didn't have that many opportunities back in Mexico. So we stayed.
Eventually, she gained residency and then citizenship. Within the recruit class, she says, her experience is unique.
A lot of my classmates had never been exposed or had never learned about immigrants and undocumented people. So it's interesting to see how they're shocked, how they realize that, yes, maybe I do have this white privilege, and what other people are going through I've never heard of or seen of before.
Before the academy started in September, the recruits all read a Harvard professor's study of undocumented young adults in Los Angeles. Then they participated in a panel discussion of the book with people from Madison's Latino community. Lieutenant Tim Patton says the goal was to help the recruits start building relationships.
On the most simple level, it might simply be understanding how one's immigration status or having a family member with undocumented status will potentially impact our ability to talk to one another.
Madison Police Chief Mike Koval has reiterated after the election that the MPD does not act as an immigration authority. The department's code of conduct forbids officers from asking people to show immigration documents, except in cases where they're assisting immigration and customs enforcement. Still, navigating these relationships is new for many of the recruits. They asked a lot of questions about how immigrants perceive officers and what fears they may have. The panel members said these conversations are important because there's still a lot of built-in mistrust of law enforcement within the Latino community. Patton says he hopes the conversation will help the recruits be more respectful and empathetic.
For us, it's really that they walk up to the door with more understanding, and they'll spend a little bit more time trying to get to know each other, and they come into it just with more knowledge and compassion about that citizen and why they might be getting the response they're getting.
Laura Minero co-founded the advocacy organization Dreamers of UW-Madison. She was 5 years old when her parents handed her off to another family to make the crossing from Mexico to the U.S., and they reunited after. She told the recruits that she's feared law enforcement for most of her life.
That fear that once you come into contact with law enforcement, you're going to be deported. That fear that you're going to be taken away from your kids and what's going to happen to your kids. Are they going to go into foster care? The list of fears just go on, and it certainly prevents people from reporting crimes that they're a victim to.
But she says in some ways, speaking on the panel transformed her personal perception of the police.
But I think the work just needs to be done on both ends and breaking down the stigmas and the stereotypes that we have about each other. And I think that that's key and crucial to any work that we do when we're trying to build allyship and understanding across communities.
In our next installment, we'll take a look at how the recruits learn about mental health issues. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Some radio news from Norway. Starting today, the country is phasing out its FM radio signals.
The country is replacing FM radio with DAB, not the dance move, but digital audio broadcasting. Apparently with lots of hills and valleys and fjords and whatnot, it's hard to get a solid FM signal to people all over the country, and the digital signal will work better.
Norwegians are not entirely on board. A majority disagree with the plan in some polls, and there are worries that millions of radios and car radios will suddenly become useless, and without working radios, a lot of people wouldn't get emergency broadcasts.
But that plan moves forward, and it could be a precedent for other countries. So this seems like a real good time to mention that you can listen to Wisconsin Public Radio through the WPR app or online at WPR.org on the device of your choice.
I'd like to think this is not going to happen anytime soon. I like my FM radio. There are not a lot of fjords in Wisconsin.
True.
So we should be good for a while,
maybe
right?
Maybe not enough fjords. You know, Norway, just over 5 million people. There's fewer Norwegians than there are Wisconsinites. I checked the math. Think about that.
It's crazy.
Yeah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.